NPR's Uri Berliner has been trying to figure out what to do with some of his savings. The money in his bank account is losing value to inflation, something many of us are familiar with. So for our series Dollar for Dollar, Uri has taken $5,000 of his own and is putting it to work exploring different types of investments. Today, the stock market offers an unexpected lesson in psychology.
Deciding how to invest in the stock market can be kind of daunting. That's why I called on someone who's seen it all.
My name is Charlie Ellis, and I've had 50 years of experience in investment management from virtually every perspective.
Ellis founded Greenwich Associates, a research and consulting firm, and wrote an influential investing book called Winning the Loser's Game. His advice? Don't fear being boring. Embrace boring if you can. Passive, it's better than active.
Most of the people who are trying harder are actually hurting themselves.
When Americans invest in the stock market, it's usually through mutual funds. There are two varieties: actively traded funds, where an investment manager and his team try to pick winning stocks, and index funds that passively mimic a benchmark, like the S&P 500. Charlie Ellis says those actively traded funds, they're a bad bet.
Candidly, the data is very disturbing. More than half, comfortably more than half, over any reasonable 12-month period, fall short of the target they chose for themselves. And if you say, well, a year is too little, you really ought to extend it. Make it 10 years, it rises from about 60% fall short over 1 year to about 70% fall short over 10 years. And while the data gets pretty thin by the time you get it out to 20 years, it gets even worse. It goes up somewhere around 80% fall short.
For Ellis, this is a crucial point. A significant majority of funds that rely on managers to make trades do worse than passive index funds. And those active funds that happen to shine for a few years, you can't be sure they'll do it again in the future. The Warren Buffetts of the world are rare, and I'm not one of them. That's why Charlie Ellis is telling me, don't try to beat the market.
Well, it's not that you can't, it's that you won't.
The odds, he says, are stacked against me. The stacking comes from something called the expense ratio. It's the annual fee the fund charges you for the manager's salary and various administrative costs.
People pay way too much attention to past returns and way too little attention to the fees.
That's Terrence O'Dean, a finance professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. While fees for actively managed funds have been coming down, they still charge almost 1% a year on average. Average fees for index funds are much more modest, just over 0.1%. Over the long haul in a retirement account, those higher fees can cost an investor tens of thousands of dollars.
One thing about fees is high fees this year almost always means high fees next year. In fact, you know what your fees are going to be next year. But high performance this year doesn't really tell you too much about next year's performance.
So that must mean most investors seek out lower cost index funds to avoid those fees. Actually, they don't. There's more than six times as much money invested in actively managed funds, some $9.8 trillion, according to the Investment Company Institute. I wanted to find out why those numbers are lopsided in favor of higher cost funds. Brian Smith speaks on behalf of the mutual fund industry for the trade group MFEA. When I asked him to make the case for actively managed funds, he said they give investors a chance to beat the market.
People want to build wealth over time. They want to build their futures. And to do that, you need to have a diversified plan, which is across a spectrum of different areas of the investing marketplace. And there's where an active manager can make a big difference.
Charlie Ellis says that may be true, but probably not. He says instead, many investors are tempted by company marketing and media coverage that focuses on hot streaks.
And so you have the feeling that, oh, come on, people are winning. It looks sensible to win. In every other part of my life, I've always played to win. That must be one of the things that can be done here. Let me get the right fund or the right manager, and I'm going to be a winner.
Finally, and this is where the psychology comes in, lots of people who study financial behavior say we're just too confident in our ability to spot good investments.
Life feels better to the extent that you have this belief that things are going to be better than reality suggests.
Max Bazerman is a Harvard professor who studies business psychology. He calls this overconfident frame of mind motivated bias, and he says it can be helpful in pushing us to reach a goal, say in sports, or landing a new job, or even fighting an illness.
Positive illusions may be fine for helping us cope. They may be fine for motivating us, but we don't want to have those positive illusions when we're at the moment of decision.
Now I'm at that moment of decision, ready to pull the trigger on my investment in the stock market. And despite everything I've heard, I still have a real temptation to want to beat the market. So can you talk me out of it?
I don't know if I can talk you out of it. I'd be happy to try.
Bazerman is pretty blunt. What makes me think I'll be on the right side of a trade and not the wrong one? What makes me think I can pick the right fund manager? Is there any reason whatsoever for thinking I would have a competitive advantage?
So I would ask you to think about, why do you think that you can outperform the market, realizing that if you pay an extra percent a year on your investments over the next 20 years, you're giving up 20%.
That's a ballpark estimate, but over the years, it still adds up to a huge amount going to fees. It's so big that when I finally decide to buy, I look for someone who knows how to find a bargain. Miranda Marquit is a personal finance blogger. She developed a grudge against high fees after winding up in some expensive funds when she was younger.
The very top fund on the list is the U.S. Large Cap ETF, and this has an expense ratio of 0.04%. So that's low.
We're shopping online together for exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. They're similar to mutual funds.
Next, they've got the U.S. Broad Market ETF. So that's also a very low expense ratio, and it includes everything in the U.S. market.
For some geographical balance, we're also checking out an international fund.
Yeah, that one would be a good one. So you can get most of the total world stocks. It's pretty low expense ratio, and it'll expose you to everything in the world.
In the end, I spend $749 on a broad U.S. stock fund, $652 on a global fund, and $577 on a stock fund that pays out regular dividends. I've got diversification in stocks, and the fees are low. It's a boring portfolio, really boring. But that's the point. I'll have to find my thrills elsewhere. Rory Berliner, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. President Obama yesterday called for reining in patent lawsuits, saying they've become a huge problem for the tech industry. He announced several executive orders aimed at protecting innovators. It's not just big firms like Apple and Samsung suing each other. Some companies have begun to use patents to sue small businesses and individuals, arguing that simply by using a technology or a piece of software, they are infringing on a patent. NPR Zoe Chace has the story of how one patent owner is going after a comedian.
The comedian is Marc Maron. He has this very popular podcast. In fact, one of the most popular podcasts out there, called WTF. Can't tell you what it stands for here on the radio. The first two letters are what the. He interviews other comedians and artists out of his garage in California. He went to check the mail recently, a P.O. box, and inside he found an extraordinary letter saying basically by doing his podcast out of his garage, he was violating a technology patent.
The 504 patent covers important technology related to automatically identifying and retrieving media files representing episodes and a series of those episodes becoming available. These patented techniques are commonly used in podcasting.
Turns out there's this guy across the country in New Hampshire who says he invented podcasting. He says every time someone creates a podcast and distributes it, that person owes his company money. When Marc Maron started up his podcast, he didn't think he was stealing anyone's invention. He's a comedian. He'd never seen a patent before.
And they sent a copy of the patent with this letter, which is very helpful to a layman, a patent, which looks like a large bunch of legal gibberish that he's now retrofitting into an extortion racket.
A couple other podcasters have received similar letters. Jesse Thorne, host of the public radio show Bullseye, NBC, CBS, The Adam Carolla Show, they've all been sued. One major irony here, the patent holder doing the suing, he does not have a podcast himself. He doesn't really listen to them or know how they're put together. And yet,
I'm one of the co-inventors of podcasting, yes.
This is Jim Logan, the man behind the letters. He fashions himself as a classic, scrappy American inventor. In 1996, he had this idea, a device that could download audio from the internet and play it.
All the personal stuff that you wanted to listen to. It has come to pass that, you know, we didn't use these words back then, but the idea of, you know, downloading playlists to your audio player and podcasts are how the world's kind of gotten around to actually implementing those ideas.
Back in the mid-90s, Jim Logan started a company called Personal Audio to try to build such a device. He wasn't able to, and he went with a much lower-tech version of what he feels is the same idea. This is the first podcast, says Jim Logan. It's a cassette tape.
Welcome to Amazing, the best of popular science, brought to you by Magazines on Tape.
The idea was that you, the listening public, would pick from a selection of articles and his company would send you a tape of those articles being read out loud.
Coming up, answers to some questions you have probably wondered about. What happens in your head when you have a headache? How does quicksand work?
The tapes didn't work out, but he still had a patent on the idea. Over the next 10 years, Logan says he kind of forgot about these audio patents until he remembers the year 2007, when he and his patent attorney, Charlie Call, realized the moment had come for the old audio patents.
I wasn't a big music listener, and Charlie Call wasn't either. We didn't own iPods. We didn't even use iTunes. So it was all kind of foreign to us. So he went off on another project, explored iTunes, and then he realized that the personal audio patents that we had filed years before were actually being infringed by iTunes.
Jim Logan's company, Personal Audio, didn't create iTunes or the Zune or the iPod, and his patents wouldn't have told you how to build them, like what lines of code to put in the software, where exactly you'd put the microprocessor. But once the engineers at Apple do figure that out, he comes along and says, hey, this was all my idea. I asked his licensing guy, Richard Baker, you can really do that?
If you have the idea of the thing, don't you have to invent the way to get it?
This is the roadmap that would tell someone how to do podcasting, how to do MP3 players. A lot of the roadmap is right here in the columns of this patent.
Do you think that the guy that invented iTunes read your roadmap? What if they just came up with it on their own, but they actually had the capacity to build the thing?
That does not make a difference in the world of patents.
That's how it works. And a lot of people think this is a big problem. The fact that somebody like Jim Logan could even get a patent this broad means that the patent system is not working like it's supposed to. Rather than encouraging more innovation, it hurts it. In Jim Logan's case, his company sued Apple, saying the ability to make a playlist in iTunes that infringed his patent. And he won. The jury awarded Logan's company $8.5 million. There have been appeals, a settlement, none of it's public. To Jim Logan, this is the system working as it should. When he uses patents to make back money that he lost on a failed business, that makes it safer for people like him to try to start the next one. The people he's threatening to sue, of course, don't see it like that.
I'm not a rich guy. I don't run a tech company. I'm a guy who turns on his computer and does his thing.
Mark Maron, scared podcaster, could find reason for hope that the president is on his side of this battle. Yesterday, in his call for reform, Obama specifically called for more protection for what he calls end users, people who aren't making a new tech product, just turning on their computers and doing their thing. Zoe Chase, NPR News.
The summer of 1963 was a boiling point in the nation's violent struggle over civil rights. NPR will spend this summer looking back 50 years at the seminal events that gave Black Americans their constitutional rights.
We'll start with a remembrance of slain NAACP leader Medgar Evers. Once reviled by many conservative whites in his home state of Mississippi, but now honored. Former President Bill Clinton, the Evers family, and others will gather at his gravesite in Arlington National Cemetery today. This is one of several tributes planned this month. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
For Evers' widow, Merle Evers Williams, the memories are still raw. Her family lived in terror behind the locked doors of their Jackson, Mississippi home.
It's a little difficult not to become emotional when I set foot on the soil.
She's standing outside the modest three-bedroom ranch-style home in what was once known as the Elrain neighborhood. In the 1950s, it was one of the first new subdivisions built for African Americans in Mississippi's segregated capital city.
This is where the refrigerator was.
Walking through the tiny kitchen, Evers Williams points out the back window, where she grew rose bushes and a plum tree in the backyard. She calls this a place of love and of agony. The family moved here when Evers accepted a job as the NAACP's first field secretary in the South, a job that made him a target of the white supremacist who would stop at nothing to preserve Jim Crow.
Medgar became number one on the Mississippi to kill list, and we never knew from one day to the next what would happen. I lived in fear of losing him. He lived being constantly aware that he could be killed at any time.
The house was firebombed. The kitchen phone rang constantly with threats. Even today, scars remain.
The bullet came through the window, hit the wall, came through here, took the tile off, ricocheted, hit the door of the refrigerator, left a dent about this size.
The bullet had killed Medgar Evers as he pulled into the driveway just after midnight on June 12, 1963. Inside the house, the Evers' three young children heard the gunfire. Rena Evers Everett, just 8 at the time, says they immediately acted out the emergency drill their family had practiced time and time again.
My brother Darrell and I dropped to the floor and pulled our younger brother down and started for this bathroom and to go into the tub as we were taught, and left our younger brother Van in the tub, and Darrell and I bolted yelling for my mother for the door, and then we stopped and ran down the steps and begged our father to get up.
They found him on the carport in a pool of blood, shot in the back. The murder made national news, including this NBC broadcast.
15 minutes past midnight, Evers got out of his car beside his home in a Negro residential area. In a vacant lot about 40 yards away, a sniper fired a single shot from a high-powered rifle at Evers' silhouette.
It was yet another report of the brutal response to civil rights activists in the South. Just a month before, police in Birmingham had turned fire hoses and police dogs on young Alabama protesters. The violence in 1963 grabbed the nation's attention and galvanized support for the Civil Rights Act. Medgar Evers had been laying the groundwork for nearly a decade by then. In his role as field secretary for the NAACP, he traveled the state, registering voters, organizing boycotts of segregated businesses, and encouraging activists not to be intimidated. Like in this March 1963 speech at a mass meeting in Greenwood, Mississippi.
All we want you to do is keep going with this fight for freedom. And as we stick together here, as you feel the pains of dogs here in Greenwood, we'll feel them in Jackson. And if we feel them in Jackson, you feel them here. And when we get this unity, ladies and gentlemen, nothing can stop us. We're going to win this fight for freedom. Thank you very much.
Evers also tried to lift what his widow calls the cotton curtain that had kept the violence in Mississippi hidden from the rest of the nation. One of his first NAACP assignments was investigating Emmett Till's murder in 1955.
Mississippi is a race-haunted place.
Susan Glisson is director of the William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation at the University of Mississippi.
It took grassroots women and children and men to lead the effort for social change, and it was much harder in Mississippi than other places. And that story needs to be told. It's not just this easy, Martin stood up and Rosa sat down and everybody's free.
At the State Archives in Jackson, where Medgar Evers' life's work is on display, Glisson says he painstakingly documented every murder, beating, firebombing, or other act of violence in Mississippi.
He would interview people, collect photographs when he could, and share that information with the NAACP and widely so that, you know, there couldn't be this sense of denial that folks were happy and that nothing was happening that was retaliatory for civil rights activity.
Glisson says Evers' strategy of attacking Jim Crow from the ground up expanded the role of the NAACP, which had been mainly focused on legally dismantling the infrastructures of racism. Julian Bond, a founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, recalls the debate within the larger civil rights movement.
Could you attack segregation in a place like Mississippi from within, or did it have to be attacked from without? It was good to have these local people working here, doing what they could, but we're going to really try to pressure it from outside. Well, that doesn't work. got to do something. You got to go right to the heart of the beast. And Medgar Evers was the first person to do that.
Bond, on a recent trip to Jackson, was amazed to see the airport bearing Medgar Evers' name and downtown signs with Evers' picture announcing the 50th anniversary events. Bond says that's something he never thought he'd see.
I marvel sometimes at the changes, and of course it's easy to say it's not enough, because it's not enough. There are still things that need to be done. But I think the way this state, Mississippi, was 50 years ago and the way it is now, the change is just enormous. I mean, I used to be afraid when I drove through Mississippi. I'm not afraid now. I'm going to drive through Mississippi day after tomorrow to Alabama. I'm not afraid to go to Alabama anymore.
But the change was slow to come. It was 30 years after the killing before a Mississippi jury convicted Evers' assassin, white supremacist Byron D. LeBeckwith, and even longer for the state to fully embrace Evers' legacy. Over the next week, Evers will be honored with a series of events culminating in Jackson next Wednesday, the 50th anniversary of his death. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
They laid Medgar Evers in his grave. He fought for freedom. Oh.
In golf, the St. Jude Classic is underway in Memphis. For the big-name players taking part in the charity tournament, it is the last stop before the U.S. Open. Commentator Frank DeFord says he'll be doing the difficult double act of paying attention to the action on the course while rolling his eyes.
When my old pal, the sports curmudgeon, had some mildly churlish things to say about golf a few weeks ago, both he and I were upbraided by loyal linksters. As one snapped at me, "You don't know anything about golf." Perhaps, but I do know all about golf propaganda. Because major golf tournaments continue to maintain a 19th-century pose and require golfers to keep their own score, instead of having a paid scorekeeper and a 21st-century electronic device to tally the number of shots, as is the case in every other big-time sport, golf loves to pretend that this somehow makes the sport more noble. The tiresome network shills can never stop boasting about how golf is a more honorable game than all the others. But really, it's just silly. Is there anything more archaic than after a round which is dragged on for several hours, every shot dutifully recorded on TV, the golfers must repair to some secret rendezvous where I believe there is an abacus to make sure that everybody can count to 71. Then they sign their scorecards like they were the Declaration of Independence. Imagine, sign here, Mr. LeBron James, to certify that you really did make the 36 points that we all saw you score on network television. Now, to start with, the primary contention that it is golfers alone who keep their own score is itself a shibboleth. Go to any club or public park, watch the tennis players, the handball players, the guys playing basketball. They all keep their own score, just like golfers. And for that matter, you don't think it's more ethically challenging calling a cross-court shot that your tennis opponent slugged into the corner than it is hitting your own stationary ball sitting there still on a tee? The only difference between golf and every other sport is that golf alone ludicrously persists in having its professionals play by the same antiquated rules as weekend duffers. Oh, I've got a good idea. Let's get rid of linesmen and have Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray keep their own score at Wimbledon to prove how honorable they are. Look, golf may be a fine game, but nothing is more irritating than to hear this con that its players are pure and chivalrous, while all other athletes are immoral scoundrels. Cut the PR folderol. I guarantee you that Diogenes didn't put away his lantern when he first stumbled onto a golf course.
Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. His latest book, Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer, is now out in paperback. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montagne.
Fans of Star Wars know that this is a clip of Princess Leia.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
The 1977 movie has been translated into many languages, and on July 3rd, you'll be able to hear Princess Leia in this language.
Could Obi-Wan Kenobi, on the day in that you see his sin.
That is Navajo, and translating the movie into Navajo is the brainchild of Manuelito Wheeler, who's director of the Navajo Nation Museum in Wind Rock, Arizona. Mr. Wheeler joins us now from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Welcome to the program.
Oyate, which means hello, greetings, and the Navajo language.
Well, what gave you the idea to translate Star Wars into Navajo?
Well, we needed a way to preserve our culture. Language is at the core of a culture. I felt we needed a more contemporary way to reach not just young people, but the population in general. And so that's when the idea of translating a major movie into the Navajo language came up.
So the point here is, if kids go to see Star Wars dubbed into Navajo, it's very possible that they already know the movie in English and would understand it perfectly well that way.
Absolutely. And that's where I connect to this process as well, because I'm not fluent in Navajo. I grew up on the Navajo Nation, around the Navajo language. Both of my parents speak Navajo, yet I don't. And there are thousands and thousands of us out there that are in that same situation. So when you watch a movie like Star Wars, where you pretty much already know many of the famous phrases from it, and then you hear it in Navajo, that's the connection right there.
We learned, by the way, in that clip how to say Obi-Wan Kenobi in Navajo. It's obviously Obi-Wan Kenobi. How do you say May the Force be with you in Navajo?
That's been the number one question being asked of me since I started this project. But we're not going to give out that famous phrase. Come to the movie on July 3rd and you'll find out. I'll save you a seat right up front. So come over.
How many people worked on the translation?
We had a team of five translators, and in my mind, they pulled off a miracle. You know, there was some talk out there, they're like, oh, how are you going to say a robot? Because there's no word for a robot in Navajo. It's such a powerful language that it's very descriptive, very descriptive. If you ask for an object in Navajo, you will know you'll be getting a round object, you'll be getting a skinny, soft object, you'll be getting a flat, rigid object. So the trick was choosing from the variety of definitions that the group came up with. So, for example, robot. Mm-hmm. It's a thinking machine, a machine that thinks for itself.
This was the movie that gave us droid, wasn't it? It made it a popular word. Do you just go with droid, or do you have to come up with a Navajo word for droid?
No, we came up with words for droid.
Really?
And come to July 3rd and you'll see.
Okay. Okay, you're giving away very little here. Well, on July 3rd, when the Secrets of Translation will be out, mm-hmm. and when you'll show the Navajo dubbed version of what actually will happen? Will there be is there a particular big theater where it's going to be, or are people going to?
No. The premier sponsor that came forward was Navajo Nation Parks and Recreation. They do the Navajo Nation Fair and the 4th of July Fair. So I will premiere it at the 4th of July celebration on July 3rd. We have a grandstand there on the fairgrounds, mm-hmm. and we are having a screen built on a semi-flatbed trailer. So when we're ready, we'll drive that out and set up chairs, and the grandstands are right there, and have popcorn for as many as we can make popcorn for.
Mr. Wheeler, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's Manuelito Wheeler, who's director of the Navajo Nation Museum. On July 3rd, they'll unveil a new version of Star Wars on the Navajo Nation Indian Reservation in Arizona.
With Spain's economy in tatters, the country is doing lots of finger-pointing at who is responsible for squandering the nation's prosperity. The latest suspect, a once untouchable institution, the Spanish royal family. Lauren Freya reports from Madrid.
The reputation of the current Spanish king, Juan Carlos, was cemented one day 32 years ago. Armed Civil Guard officers stormed the Spanish parliament, holding lawmakers hostage in an attempted coup. The king went on live TV denouncing the officers.
La corona, símbolo de la permanencia y unidad de la patria, no puede tolerar.
The crown cannot tolerate any action that interrupts the strength of the democratic process, he said. The coup fell apart, and Juan Carlos was credited with keeping this country a democracy. All that goodwill lasted until very recently, when Spain's economy fell apart. Suddenly, the royal lifestyle feels like an insult to some Spaniards.
So I'm totally against Sophie. Totally, because why? I should pay their food or their clothes, their jewelry. I don't want to pay them.
Sandra Wong lingers in a park with her boyfriend before work. She earns about $950 a month and resents any of her taxes going to the royals. The palace has picked up on this growing anger and announced that the king will give up his $27 million yacht, which costs $30,000 just to refuel. All this after Juan Carlos was discovered elephant hunting last year in Africa. That safari cost many times the average Spaniard's annual salary. I'm very sorry, the king told reporters outside his hotel room last spring. I made a mistake and it won't happen again. The king's poll numbers have hit record lows, something Spanish media are reporting on for the first time. Royal watchers like Hugh O'Donnell, who wrote a book about Juan Carlos, can scarcely believe how quickly public deference has evaporated. I reached him via Skype in Scotland.
I was in Catalonia in the early 90s when he was coming to open one of the stadia for the Barcelona Olympics, and he arrived late, and it was an open secret that he was held up to a dalliance with his then mistress in Mallorca. But although this was an open secret, the media certainly didn't cover it.
But now they do. The king's latest headache comes from his youngest daughter, Infanta Cristina. Judges are investigating whether her husband embezzled millions of dollars from charities he ran. And they're probing the princess's tax returns as well for any evidence of money laundering on her part. Even the editor of the monarchist newspaper ABC, Bieto Rubido, acknowledges that the Spanish royal family wants an outsider to take the heat. The problem with the princess is her husband, he says. Iñaki Urdangarin took advantage of his relations with the royals to benefit himself. The king has cut his son-in-law out of the royal budget. The island of Mallorca even changed signs on a street named after Urdangarin. Some Spaniards are ashamed. Others roll their eyes and fret more about the economy. Thousands of protesters hit Madrid's streets every weekend. At this anti-corruption rally, someone makes a wisecrack about the royal family, and the crowd launches into a fiery debate over how much the princess, Infanta Cristina, was involved in her husband's dealings.
You are under the same roof, sleeping in the same bed, so it's impossible not to know anything about his activities.
Roberto Nogueres is a community activist here.
Direct democracy demonstrations in the street, okay? Yes, there are contradictions with monarchy, okay? And I think that most of us really want a referendum, want to decide, okay, if we want to have a king or not.
He's unlikely to get that vote. Spain is a constitutional monarchy. When the 75-year-old king dies, his son will take over. But as time passes and memory fades of that attempted coup in 1981, the role of Spain's monarchy may change for good. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.